are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 4th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, Corey Robin, will be here on the enigma of Clarence Thomas. Also on the program today, all four White House officials scheduled for deposition today failed to show up. Meanwhile, Trump loses his tax handover appeal, and either he gives his taxes up or it heads to SCOTUS. Nancy Pelosi jumps into the 2020 primary, says she will stop any progressive agenda. DOA in the House, ladies and gentlemen. And bye-bye, Beto.
Aw.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
So excited to be going home and overseeing my parents' parking lot empire.
Trump hinting at a government shutdown to slow the impeachment roll. In that same Trump administration, rolling back corporate tax avoidance inversion regulation. And despite the national trend, unemployment climbs in 2020 swing states. Gavin Newsom now threatening a PG&E takeover. And Trump threatens to stop the California wildfire funding. Yeah. And lastly, the heartwarming story of a lovable smuggler sawing through Donald Trump's beautiful wall. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm having a little bit of a voice issue. I don't feel bad.
I think you sound fine.
Maybe it just sounds weird to me.
No, there's a little bit of
A little bit.
Oh, I mean, if anything, it's better.
Yes, it's more sultry.
It's more Barry White, Jew White.
I was going to say, instead of the fun half today, we'll be doing some smooth jazz at 1 p.m.
Going to do some scatting.
There you go. I'm not going to do the scatting. I'm just going to cue up the smooth jazz albums. Welcome. Just a reminder. The AM Quickie is out and available to you. It is 5 minutes, gives you all the top headlines of the day. It is published almost every day before 8:30 a.m. Eastern. And it's available on all of your podcast servers, as well as the Majority Report app, which is available at majorityapp.com. If you haven't updated it, update it. Folks, the app is crushing it right now, and people are loving it. And the AMQ, as we like to call it, or the AM Quickie, is on there. And of course, you can get the live show, the YouTube show, the podcast, the member show, all of it. All of it's there, majorityapp.com, or go directly and get the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. Check it out. You will enjoy it. I sincerely hope. And also, just a reminder, this show relies on its members to exist. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. For those of you who have sent emails looking for help with a Majority Report membership, just give us a little more time, and we will be in touch. So let's jump right in here. so that we can get to Corey. Interesting story about Clarence Thomas. Really fascinating stuff. But let's start with the impeachment stuff. Now, just a couple of things, and I don't know about this, but starting to hear rumors about, or I guess rumors about questions that are happening in the Democratic caucus as to whether they should expand the impeachment inquiry. And, you know, I think my thinking about this has evolved a bit insofar as I see the value of taking or sending to the Senate articles of impeachment in time for that to force them to take a vote before the primaries. Now, I have a feeling McConnell will slow walk it if they actually are going to have a vote until after the primaries so that he can release some Republican senators. Now, the fly in the ointment is, of course, Donald Trump and his ego. We discussed this with Digby on Friday. I don't know if Donald Trump will allow for Susan Collins, say, or, you know, Cory Gardner, Joni Ernst, Tom Tillis, to vote for impeachment. This would be after the deadline is passed for a primary challenge, so that they could have some latitude in their reelection campaigns. Donald Trump may not abide by that, but that might be the attempt that they're going after. And I've heard that there are other whistleblowers in different sectors that have to do with different things. So I don't know. None of this is substantiated, so I'm not going to get into any details. But here is the minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, on one of the Sunday shows. I guess this is what
Face the Nation.
Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. And they are trying to essentially squeeze all of the juice they can out of the beginnings of this basically presentation by the Democrats, right? We have been in a phase and we remain in a phase where there are private depositions being taken. So there is no transparency at this point, as one would expect in the early stages of an investigation. Soon, the Democrats will move it into the public aspects of this investigation and will make the case to the American public and ostensibly to different members of the House, and they will vote on it. They're trying to squeeze as much juice as they can out of this because Kevin McCarthy knows a lot of this stuff is going to be made public soon, and the case is going to be there. But what they're trying to do is exactly what Bill Barr did with the Mueller testimony, the report. That is, spin it in such a way, get an idea of what they're going to hear already in the minds of Americans. First impressions do make a big difference. Here's Kevin McCarthy trying to do that right now and talking in very dramatic terms.
What you're asking, you're going to change the course, the very fabric of democracy today, based upon someone wrote a written question of somebody that wasn't even on the phone call, that had hearsay, even though we all know what the transcript said?
Well, Mike Pence would become president. Really, it wouldn't undo the election results. If the president were removed,
Margaret, you're really saying today on national television, if somebody who was not on the phone call, that you have the transcripts of the phone call, no big deal, just remove the president of the United States over a phone call?
No, that I'm just saying that it wouldn't undo the election. Believe. It would put the vice president commander-in-chief spot.
No. President Trump was duly elected as the president of the United States.
Pause it. I mean, the funny part is here, what Margaret Brennan really meant to say was, how does it undermine the fabric of democracy when impeachment is explicitly laid out in the Constitution? How does that undermine our democracy when it is a like of all the things that we see on a daily basis.
It's a statutory part of our democracy.
It's not even statute. It's a constitutional part of our democracy.
Undermining part of our democracy.
Yeah, the part that he likes good.
President of the United States, and I think democracy is too precious to think that somebody who's not on a phone call, that cannot stand before the American public and answer the questions, that somehow we would change the course of that. And we're 1 year away from today. What are they so afraid of? What do they have to hide? Why wouldn't they release one item? If you are a jury member, you have to look at all the information. You don't just get the prosecutor to give you one line from an opening statement. You get cross-examinations. You get a due process. None of that is happening here today. We have never gone down this in America, and we should stand up and not allow this ever to happen.
All right. Well, we have some questions you just laid out there to put to Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. Thank you for joining us there from New York. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Margaret.
You just heard from Leader McCarthy that this is just a wholesale rejection of the way Democrats are laying out this impeachment inquiry.
Margaret, you know what I say is we lawyers have a statement that when you have the facts, you pound on the facts. When you have the law, you pound on the law. And you neither have the facts nor the law, you pound on the table. What you just heard from my friend, the minority leader, was pounding on the table. It talks about the whistleblower. The whistleblower said, look, I heard something. Then people investigated what he heard. Mm-hmm. And the problem that Kevin has and the Republicans have is witness after witness after witness says, yes, I was there. I listened. Those are the facts. That's what's critical in any trial. You wouldn't call the whistleblower. What you call is the people who are actually there, which is.
Yeah, and that's basically what's happening. And all of this stuff about the cross-examination, all that's going to happen. I mean, it's basically like someone waiting for a trial complaining that the none of the elements of the trial are happening because the trial hasn't started yet. They're, you know, this is the only time they're going to be able to do this. And then it's going to be just they're going to try and smear. But there seems to be so many different people who have information that they almost can't get the toehold in for the smearing campaign that they want. So this should be interesting and will be happening shortly.
May I just say very briefly, thank you, Steny Hoyer. Well done. And look up Michaela Wilkes as challenger.
Indeed. Yes. Yeah. Anybody can deliver that line. In fact, just about everybody has delivered a variant on that. If you don't have the law, you have the fact. If you don't have the facts, you argue the law. If you don't have the law, you argue just to make yourself heard. Everyone has a variant of that. It's almost literally.
It's facts don't care about your feelings, basically.
It's not even that. It's just like it is a very, I think, accurate and well-worn saying. That I'm sure Michaela Wilkes will be able to say to or
Michaela
anybody else.
Michaela Wilkes will deliver that very well.
You'll get 100 different people who to do it.
We should play the end part of the video where he goes, you mad, bro?
Exactly. That also works.
You mad.
I've been debating about this as to whether it's TMI, as the kids say. But I have recently thrown out every pair of like threadbare, I'm going to say the Fruit of the Loom underwear and replaced it all with Everlane underwear. I bought like 12 pairs.
That's amazing because your mood really has improved significantly.
I honestly, this is the best underwear I've ever had in my life. And, you know, like it's, if people knew how long it takes me to move off of a certain piece of clothing, they would understand the drama involved in this.
Me and Benjamin were at the Fruit of the Loom store in 1996.
Honestly, I've been wearing the same pair of underwear. It's, you know, and like I've tried to switch to some other underwears and I had them, but I found that after a time I didn't use them. The bands on these are perfect. The fabric is perfect. And Everlane is a fascinating company. Would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost you $7 to make? Well, Everlane wouldn't. Everlane only makes premium essentials. They use the finest materials without traditional markups. And they're incredibly transparent about the whole thing. They want you to know what you're paying for and why. So they outline their real costs every step in the process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. Not to mention essentials like their cotton crew t-shirt are exactly what they should be. Versatile, simple, stylish, and made from quality materials. Everlane's clothes look better, cost less, and last longer. Brendan told me the best hoodie he has. What is it? You said the best piece of clothing you have is a hoodie you got from them. Now they have 100% grade A cashmere clothing. They have the quality cotton basics. They have premium Japanese denim made at the world's cleanest denim factory. They have Italian-made leather shoes. They have perfectly fitted Oxford shirts. Half my wardrobe is now Everlane, and I think I'm pretty close to moving to like 75%. Right now, you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/majority. Plus, you're going to get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/majority. everlane.com/majority. Go check it out. I'm telling you, you will not be disappointed. Also, you've heard me talk in the past about Capterra.com/majority. You can start making your work take less work and find the right software for you there. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. They have over 1 million reviews of products from real software users, and you can discover everything you need to make an informed decision. They have 700 specific categories of software. So no matter what business you're in, they have software for it. You will not believe how many, we've talked about this many times, but I actually like go through there and just sort of fantasize about the different type of jobs I could have or businesses. You can join millions of people who use Capterra every month to find the right tools for their business. Here are just some of the popular categories, apparently. Applicant tracking software. I guess that's basically to help you with hiring. Church software. You're doing stuff with your church. Contract management software, construction management software, field service management software, LMS software. I don't even know what that means. Maintenance software, medical practice management software, performance appraisal software, project management software. I'm going to go to performance appraisal software. Oh. They have one called Bob. I mean, they have, geez, holy cow. I can't even count how many they have. There are, I can't even tell you how many in that category. I couldn't possibly count it. But the top rated ones are on the top. One has 34 reviews. One has 280 reviews. One has 42 reviews. One has 109. One has 214, 143, 62, 41. The point is, you look at all these different softwares to basically say, like, how do I assess the performance of the different divisions of like the Majority Report or different employees. Watch out.
What?
Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified.
That would be awesome, actually. The AI would turn on you. It would be like, you are distracting your employees.
You are the
again
problem.
With another story about the 1990s.
You
let them
are
focus.
The problem.
You can't yell at them to be quiet 6 minutes before showtime when you've been talking for a full hour before.
1,045 reviews on that bamboo HR. I'm going to check that out. And if there's one that says, careful, sometimes when you're pointing a finger, three are pointing back at you. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Corey Robin, author of The Enigma of Clarence Thomas.
hustle of the spiral stair. See if anyone's left out there. Teams on the scene from several stations. Everybody adjust your expectations. Stray clumps of hair and blood and brain. Fragments of bone in the drain. Rookies try to keep the airway clear, but the damage is too severe. Bring in the cadaver.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and author of his latest, The Enigma of Clarence Thomas, Corey Robin. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back. Really happy to be here.
I think we had you on. We definitely had you on. Last time was for The Reactionary Mind, which is also a book I would highly recommend to folks. And I learned a lot from that book, actually. It sadly comes in handy with about half the things that the people that we talk about on this program, the right-wing hipsters. Aside from that, let's move into this. Well, let's just start with, because this book is less of a critique of an ideology and more of an examination of a specific, I guess, ideology that you could say of Clarence Thomas. Why Clarence Thomas?
Well, first of all, he is increasingly one of the most powerful members of the Supreme Court. You know, in the last couple of years with the appointment of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, there's been a solidified right-wing bloc on the court, and Thomas is the longest-serving justice on the current Supreme Court, which gives him seniority in certain kinds of cases. So he's a powerful figure that people are beginning to recognize and reckon with. And second of all, he's probably, you know, despite being a very well-known figure, he's probably the least well-known and most misunderstood figure on the court. People know startlingly little about him and what he thinks. And so just right there, I mean, the combination of this very powerful man in American government about whom we know very little, I think, argues for the need for such a book. And then, you know, the last thing I would say is when you bring in the fact that he's African-American, he's arguably the most powerful African-American person in the United States. And we live at a moment where I think particularly people on the left are very concerned and interested in what it is that black people have to say. And here is this extraordinarily influential voice who's African-American. And again, I think it behooves us to at least listen to what he has to say, not because he's right or anything like that, but because of the power and influence he has.
And, you know, which I did not realize because he's 9 years away from being the longest serving Supreme Court justice in the history of the country.
Yes, I know. When I did those numbers, it sort of I had the same kind of reaction. You know, he was appointed very young, and he's only 71 now. And, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, Stephen Breyer, are both well into their 80s. So, you know, Thomas, you know, Anthony Kennedy was, I think, 80, 81 when he retired. So Thomas doesn't have that long to hold on. before he really will become the longest serving justice in American history.
And we should say too that on paper at least, or I'm trying to narrowly slice this. In some ways, he's the model of what we're going to get, and maybe this is something that we should talk about at the end of our talk here today. But when we look at all of the appointees over the past two Republican administrations and this one, like, this is the model, right? We're not used to getting, I don't know how to articulate this, but it's atypical to have justices appointed in their 40s.
Right.
And have them be on the court for 40 some odd years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this has been, I mean, in some ways, this has been the plan of the right for some time. And yeah, he's the archetype. He's the prototype. And the fact that he's, you know, only coming into his own now when he still has, you know, a good number of years arguably left in his life, you know, that is something that we should be getting used to. And if nothing else, you know, the five of them, the five very hard right justices on the Supreme Court, that is a permanent lock that no matter what happens in the electoral realm, we will be grappling with for quite some time.
And lastly, just so that we get basic things out of the way, I know Clarence Thomas just from basically, I'm aware of him being a Supreme Court justice all these years, but, you know, a pubic hair on a Coke can. I mean, that was sort of, I was in my early 20s, mid-20s, I think, when I first heard those words, and they stuck with me for a long time. The other sort of, I guess, notion I have of Clarence Thomas, you know, comes from a couple of sort of rather incomplete profiles of him, journalistic publications, The New Yorker, where he's just basically renowned for not asking questions. And the implication has been also he's like checked out and he's not that active, but he's written a tremendous amount of decisions. Just give us some of those numbers so that we can sort of dispel with some of these myths.
Yeah. So he's written over 700 opinions. Not all of them by any stretch were decisions because he was, you know, dissenting. But yeah, he's written over 700 opinions, often in any given year. And I'm sorry if you just mentioned this, my cat was meowing really loudly, so I couldn't hear everything. But often in a year, he writes the most on average of any Supreme Court justice. They're very lengthy opinions. And they, were often and continue to be quite extreme. But what we've seen over the years is that they lay down a marker of a very hard right position that initially very few people will join, if anybody. But with time, people on the court slowly start coming around to. Just to give a quick example, Thomas, the Heller decision, which the gun rights decision, which declared that the Second Amendment, that the right to bear arms is an individual personal right, which came out in 2008, that was a Justice Scalia decision. But Thomas was the first one in the late 1990s on the modern court to suggest that this is how the Second Amendment ought to be interpreted. And it didn't get much attention at the time, except amongst, insiders. But of course, that provides the roadmap. And I think we can see this on a number of other issues as well. So he really, it's not just the volume of his opinions, it's that they tend to be a kind of the pace setter for what is to come down the road.
And I've in the wake of reading your book, my sense of him not speaking during the oral arguments, I don't know. I guess I'm this. I may be imposing this a little bit, but I see that as consistent with his fatalism about race on some level. Like there's a certain, I think you called it. Futilitarian. But let's wait to get there because I don't want to get ahead of myself. This is the interesting thing part, or it starts with, and you break down sort of there's three aspects, I guess, to the man or to the, not so much the man, but the Thomasian thought, I guess, is built on race, capitalism, and constitution. And you look at his intellectual and legal, and I guess his policy or his politics in some ways. Let's start with the intellectual and sort of race. He started out as and has continued in your estimation as a black nationalist. That started back at Holy Cross. And I knew a lot of guys who went to and women who went to Holy Cross, having been from Worcester. They were not black nationalists.
So he was a the part of a cohort of young black men who were recruited to integrate Holy Cross in 1968. There were 18 of them, and they were quite an illustrious, I should say, cohort of men. They include the novelist, people who would go on to things, the novelist Edward Jones, who won the Pulitzer Prize, Stanley Grayson here in New York, and some other figures. So they were, you know, quite accomplished. He was, you know, one of the poorest of them, came from the Deep South, from Georgia. And they get there, and it's 1968. Martin Luther King has been assassinated. So it's a very tumultuous time for, you know, in the nation and for black people and black activists. And they form themselves into quite a militant group called the Black Student Union. Now, that doesn't sound to us particularly militant, but at the time, the nomenclature was significant. You were really affirming blackness as a political project. And they start making demands on the university that the that Holy Cross, accept more black students, that they offer more courses in black literature, bring black artists to the campus, have black music at parties, the whole nine yards. And what it was really about was confronting a situation of massive whiteness. Thomas had grown up in pretty much an all-black environment, even though it was the Jim Crow South. And, you know, confronting, you know, being one of the few or sometimes the only black person in a white situation would prove to be a formative experience for him. And he comes out of this. And at the same time, I should say, he's reading Malcolm X. He's listening to records of Malcolm X's speeches, because this is how people, guys would hear these things. You know, this is before YouTube and the Internet. And he really imbibes a whole sort of ideology. He becomes active in a kind of Black Panthers sort of related circle. And he develops, two ideas really become formative for him with time. The first is the sense that racism is so deeply woven into the fabric of American society, of white American society, that it can never really be eliminated. It's just too deeply structured into America. And again, he never loses this idea, as we can talk about in a second. And then the second part of this, it reflects the moment, and there's an increasing sort of fatalism about being able to change any of this through political means. And so by the time he ends his sort of time on the left, he's really become incredibly politically pessimistic about the possibilities of transforming America's racial condition. And it gives rise to a kind of belief that, you know, perhaps black people need to go their own way. They need to recognize that their fate and their interests cannot be accommodated by white America, certainly not through any kind of conventional or radical political means. And instead, they need to build up their own institutions. Build up their own, economies, build up black manhood. And this is a strain, I should say, of black nationalism. It's not the whole of it by any stretch, but there are certainly elements of this you find in Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey and people like that. So that's the milieu, the late 1960s and early 1970s, even before he makes his turn to the right. It's very, very strongly race conscious. It's a belief in kind of black separatism. And ultimately, it comes to be a belief that that there are really no political avenues to ameliorate or redress these problems.
Okay, so I got a bunch of questions about that. And let me just start with Holy Cross. Were all those guys Catholics? I mean, I know that Thomas was, and I wonder how much Catholicism, because you don't touch on it too much in the book.
Yeah.
I wonder how much Catholicism informed that. Because, like I say, I don't know what percentage of my graduating high school from Daugherty High went to Holy Cross, but it was significant. And I spent some time on that campus. And there was, you know, and this, granted, this was 20 years later, but there was a specific flavor, I would say, to Holy Cross.
Yeah, I mean, I grappled with the question of Thomas's Catholicism. And one thing I didn't even talk about in the book is his first year of college, he actually was studying to be a priest at a seminary in Missouri, which he left after his first year, again, in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King, where he felt the seminary in Missouri was just incredibly racist. And this led to a big rift between him and his grandfather that wasn't really resolved until much later in life, if at all. And his grandfather was very important to him. So Catholicism, you know, certainly, and he went to Catholic schools in high school as well. So it was very important to his formation. I didn't focus on it so much because I think, you know, there are other influences and currents that explain more of how he got to where he got. But it's certainly, you know, it's certainly a part of the story.
Okay. And I suspect that comes out in some of his sort of like patriarchal ideas, but we can talk about that when we get to that. The black nationalism, when he has those ideas, like, was there a difference? Because I think you make the point that a part of this story is the idea of, like, what do you do with that black nationalism if you've decided that that project has failed in some way?
Right.
So talk about, like, what the perspective was pre, you know, going into that moment where there was a perception that it failed, and then what it looks like on the other side.
Sure. So, you know, in the 1960s, I mean, the real high water mark of participation and active militancy is really, you know, in the first half of the 1960s. And by 1968, I mean, even though you've had the rise of people like Malcolm X and Black Power, you know, it's a slow rise, and it's oftentimes in response to frustration of the impatience, really, that the failure of the kind of mainstream civil rights movement to transform things quickly enough. And so you have this bubbling up during the 1960s. And by 1968 is really the last big legislative achievement for the civil rights movement, which is the Fair Housing Act. And then you have the election of Richard Nixon, which, you know, imagine the election of Trump, but with far, far more racial violence on, you know, on both sides, far more, you know, and a war that's really, you know, not only is it a catastrophic war, but its presence is felt throughout the entirety of the society. So this is a really pretty bleak moment, I think, for people, for many people, and particularly for people in the black freedom struggle. And it's at that moment that, you know, Thomas is really coming to political consciousness and taking this kind of very militant black nationalist turn. And let's just add into that equation that throughout American history, going back to the sort of first black nationalist, you know, kind of text, the 1850s, Martin Delaney, black nationalism oftentimes gets traction and gets going precisely at these moments of political bleakness because there's a philosophy there, just about the kind of irreducible separateness and apartness of the black nation, of the black people, that unlike other peoples in the United States, their interests and their aspirations just cannot be accommodated. And so this is what propels this kind of separatist, build up the race kind of philosophy. So that's, you know, all in the mix for Thomas. And then, you know, things just start getting worse. And he graduates in 1971. It's the year of Kent State. One of the last things he does as a militant, he goes to this massive protest in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was extraordinarily violent. There was the largest, you know, protest in the history of Cambridge or something like that. And the police presence was very heavy. And I just think, you know, the overpowering sense of the futility of all of this kind of stuff just starts sinking in to him. And you marry that sense of futility. I mean, what black nationalism had going for it was, you know, amidst this political desolation, we can offer a path forward. But if now the path forward you know, of kind of more militant black nationalism seems closed, you can see, you know, the trajectory that's starting to develop there. And I'll just add up one other thing without going on too long. Many black nationalists at this moment in the early 1970s really take a turn away from politics. At the local level in particular, they start really looking to the economy as the pathway of advance. And sometimes this can mean building up just black business. Sometimes it can mean pushing for hiring of black workers. Sometimes it can mean creating a parallel black economy. But it's a very strong economistic turn that often involves a kind of renewed engagement with capitalism and the marketplace and an appreciation that this might offer us other paths. So again, this is all going on in black nationalist circles before Thomas has even begun his move to the right. And so part of the argument of the book is you can see the seeds are being planted there for someone to take a kind of right turn from these earlier leftist doctrines.
Yeah, I had a professor in college who started out as a guy who was working in the Peace Corps and prevented a military service from using an island. I think I can't remember where it was. Maybe it was a Polynesian island as a test ground for nuke weapons. And he ended up like a Reagan conservative. And yep. I think part of that was just sort of like he realized he took a tremendous beating after that and had nowhere to go. And I think he realized like if you're and the type of advice he would give me, knowing that I was of the left, was like, don't go to some law school that's all namby-pamby. Learn, you know, the skills and defeat them at that, you know, within the rules of the game as they're set, because your radicalism is futile and you will not be able to change anything enough. And you can actually do better by staying within the system and being, and I thought that was sort of a fascinating turn. And it feels like that's what happened with Thomas on some level.
And, you know, I mean, there were, you know, with Thomas, as with most of people, you know, there's a combination of factors. There was also, he goes to law school. He starts getting, debt that he has to pay back. He has a wife and a son. This is from his first marriage. There are all kinds of things that would say, you know, maybe militancy is not the path to take. But again, I don't, you know, some people say, aha, you see, this was all pure strategic opportunism. The fact of the matter is that there was an easy path for him to do if that's all that he cared about. He temporarily, for a couple of years, had a job with Monsanto in Missouri, and that was a lucrative corporate gig. And he could have just stayed on that path and done that. But that, you know, he's remains a political person in the sense that he, has a project. I think, you know, the constellation of ideas that he had developed on the left then come hitting up against the wall of this defeat with the right-wing backlash and the sort of stalling of the black freedom struggle, I think leads him to think there's got to be a better path, one that is not through the political sphere, but perhaps through kind of more economic modes of development. And that really does set him up for his turn to the right.
And I have to say that I think like it's, I mean, my perception of Thomas was a guy who sort of ignored racism, but it sounds like it's just the opposite on some level. He perceives it as being immutable in the context of the United States. Talk about that sort of racial pessimism, which is, you know, and where it's shared on the left.
Yeah. So it's all, I mean, you know, not only do you see, I mean, what was so interesting to me in doing the research for this book was that previous biographers had noted that Thomas had this past at Holy Cross and in the early 70s at Yale Law School, and then thought it was over and that was it. What was so striking to me was how persistent this belief in the immutability of racism, the intractability of racism is, and that it's all over his jurisprudence. And it comes up in all kinds of corners and circumstances where you would not expect it. But the beliefs are that, you know, well, there's a couple. One is, I think it's an essentially psychological theory of racism. It's not particularly political or economic, but by that I mean he thinks that, white people are racist. He says, how it began, we don't know. How it will ever end, probably, we certainly don't know and probably can't see. It almost has no roots at all, and I think he thinks it's part of a kind of an assumption of superiority that white people just have. And so then it gets expressed in two forms, racism. So that's where it comes from. It's a kind of psychological motivation, attitudes. And it gets expressed either in the stigma that gets put onto black people, where they are assumed to be inferior, and there's all kinds of ways in which Thomas traces this out, or it comes out in the form of unconscious biases, when white people think of themselves as anti-racist or non-racist, but nevertheless, their language, their claims, their beliefs, their statements always betrays the unconscious racism that's there. And what's amazing is that, both of those ideas, stigma and unconscious bias, are pretty much the cornerstones of the contemporary social psychology of race in academia. So Thomas is, what makes him a kind of peculiar figure and difficult to get your head around is he really accepts, I think, some basic left-wing or liberal, I should say, or liberal and left-wing, it depends, ideas about racism, how deeply rooted it is, that it has this kind of very deep psychic source, all the rest of it, but does not think the standard left-wing or liberal ideas follow from that. And so what you're left with is a very deep racial pessimism that is kind of the structuring core. I mean, as you said, the book begins with race, and then goes to capitalism, and then goes to constitution. Race is the bedrock of his worldview. And in that sense, that it doesn't really have a politics, that it's it's so deeply rooted in individuals, that we find it in individuals. I do think it reflects kind of larger currents of how we deal with the left. How we deal with race on the left. Very much focused on people's individual biases. We use the phrase structural racism, which used to mean something like when I was in graduate school, it meant something very different. I think what people mean by it now is, white people are racist. All white people are racists. That's very much similar. That's Thomas's. That's the bedrock of Thomas's belief.
But isn't because you say that it's for him, racism is all psychological, and it feels to me that even but you would know better, and maybe I'm just I'm looking at it, my race colored glasses, I guess, or maybe not looking at this. From a distance, but I do think that people do have a different sense of what structural racism is. I mean, I tend to think that there is an understanding of structural racism, and also even in the liberal left, and certainly in the sort of left of liberal, there is an understanding that on some level, class and a political economy, contributes to this. Does he have, is his notion of race completely divorced from that in terms of its origins?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he doesn't really have an account of origins. I'm sure if you were to press him, he'd see he was caught up in the history of slavery. But like many people, I think he would probably think that racism preceded slavery and inspired slavery as opposed to emerging out of slavery. So he doesn't have a very materialistic understanding at all. There is no political economy. It's very much a social psychology, a social psychological theory of race. And I do think that is pretty common amongst a lot of liberals. I mean, I was really just sort of a side note, but I was struck this past week, and there was a bit of a fight between Elizabeth Warren and her critics, her kind of more mainstream Democratic critics, because she had compared the struggle for Medicare for all to the struggle for women's suffrage and civil rights movement and even the abolition of slavery. And I think it was Carol Moseley Braun said, abolition of slavery, that didn't involve raising taxes. It was about getting rid of privilege. And I thought, actually, the abolition of slavery from a material point of view was was far more consequential than a simple raising of taxes. It was a huge dispossession of property. And there was this notion of privilege as if it were somehow apart from material life. And I think that's very common, actually, on the left and amongst liberals, is to see, you know, to look for racism in kind of the speech acts of people, to look for it in the way people treat other people, but not to pay enough attention to, you know, things like healthcare differentials or wealth differentials and things like that. So I don't see it as a race versus class issue. It's more like, do you see the materiality of racism? And again, when I say all this, Thomas is very in sync with all of that. He doesn't really dwell too much on the materiality of racism. It's all the kind of the biases and the speech acts and the way people are treated that really matter.
All right. So and so much, it seems, of his perception of both capitalism and the Constitution are, it seems to me, a function of that, that there is a an essential quality to racism that can never go away, because it's almost in the, to the extent that it's structural, it is like almost like structural in the way that it's neurological. And that it is a permanent feature of people who are Caucasian and others, and it's always going to be with us. And so how do we, and so his project, as you call it, is still informed by that reality, or his reality, that racism is a permanent fixture in this country. So what then it becomes basically, anytime the government attempts to deal with race, it's worse for black people.
Yes.
All right. So, because now we're getting into the sort of the realm where people may recognize a little bit, like black people are in some way, like the hammock has turned into a, you know, like a, what is it? The safety net has become like a sticky hammock in some way,
right,
or something.
Right. So, you know, the argument of the book is not simply that just, you know, Clarence Thomas is a black nationalist. It's also that he's a conservative black nationalist. And I think this is, as you say, where some of this starts seeming a little bit more intelligible. But I think before we get to things like the welfare state, I think we got to begin, first of all, with his hostility to politics in general. This goes back to the 1970s and the 1980s. He gave an amazing interview to Juan Williams in The Atlantic, and where he talks about the idea of black people mobilizing through the vote. And he says, you know, let's say we got organized and acted, you know, had some kind of group power in the electoral sphere, you know, something like gerrymandering or something like that. You know, what's going to happen? We are the group on the bottom, and every single time we will lose. We will get the hell beaten out of us. And the only people who are going to be worse off than we would be, he says, maybe American Indians. And so, at the heart of this is this belief that black people's political involvement is at best a fool's errand, and at worst will only make them further dependent upon the benevolence and good wishes of white people. If you read his voting rights jurisprudence, something that, you know, is sort of exhibit A for most people, that this is, you know, the worst part of Thomas. When you read it carefully, what he's really saying is, yes, it's very clear that black people have a common interest. That he doesn't doubt. And yes, it's very clear that they're at the bottom. That he doesn't doubt. But it's when you start translating that into the political realm through kind of, some kind of method of empowering black voters to elect black officials, let's say, he sees all manner of mischief following from it. And the bottom line is, he just would prefer black people stay out of that world. And then he looks at a whole bunch of state policies. And what's, again, fascinating is whether it's on disparate impact, which is a whole realm of doctrinal law in the Constitution, or the Takings Clause, which is, you know, another big part of the Constitution, or the Commerce Clause. The overwhelming argument and pervasive theme is all these efforts to redress and improve the condition of black people by the state only ends up harming black people. And I think, you know, affirmative action for him is really, you know, exhibit A of this. And what's so fascinating about his affirmative action opinions is he doesn't, like most white conservatives, take the principle of colorblindness and say affirmative action is wrong because you're treating black people differently from white people and that's unfair to the white person. What he says instead is that affirmative action is a way not of creating a stigma against black people, but perpetuating a pre-existing stigma of black people. That the only way you can get ahead is through the assistance and benevolence of white people. And it doesn't matter if you got ahead without affirmative action or not, everybody who's black is stained by affirmative action and their achievements are called into question, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, it empowers white people because he sees the administrators of affirmative action programs at universities and the decision makers as white. It empowers them to make discretionary judgments about which black people they will associate with and choose to include in their sort of ruling class circles. So he thinks it enhances white discretionary power and increases black dependence upon that power. So this is just a whole range of arguments that he's mounting to say, you know, when the state involves itself in trying to help black people, it makes things worse. So on the one hand, you have that. And then on the other hand, we have his vision of capitalism, which, again, he's not that he
Let's just hold there because I want to just ask you some questions about that notion of race. And when you say that he doesn't accept the typical conservative view of like you're discriminating against white people. Because at one point, I think you write, and I can't remember the ruling off the top of my head. Maybe it's in the context of University of Michigan Law School case that, like, look, white people, you don't want to get into a tit for tat as to who's been victimized by race more because you're going to lose, essentially. But his argument is, and we should also say that, like, he benefited from affirmative action, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
I guess it's impossible to, and maybe you have a sense of this, like, to what extent did he feel that that impacted him in that way?
Huge. Go ahead.
Well, and address that. And also this notion of, it also seems to me that in all of those calculations he's making about voting, about admissions to colleges, that even if whites maintain, even if I accept the premise that all white people are going to be just as racist as they are, you know, 200 years ago, today and tomorrow, I mean, just sheer population numbers, right, would have some impact on my perception as to whether this is going to be relevant in the future.
I was going to take the second first, but.
Take the affirmative action one first, and then I'll remind you of the numbers.
Okay. Thomas gets into Yale Law School on an affirmative. It's kind of a strict quota program, although far more strict than a previous quota that had been used. And that's, you know, Yale Law School is this sort of transformative moment for him because he feels like up until that point he had been told repeatedly that you got this far despite being black. And the thing that he at least valued that was that he could say, you see, these achievements that I have under my belt, I didn't get them from the help of white people. I got them through, you know, my own personal grit and talent, but also through the help of black people. And so they were achievements. And this is important to note, like, Thomas is not a rugged individualist. He's not an impersonal meritocrat or anything like that. He really does believe that his achievements were due to the kind of mutual provision, collective provision of the black community, and particularly of his grandfather and the black family. But then he says, you get to Yale Law School, and now the line is, before, if you got ahead despite your race, now you're getting ahead because of your race. And the people who are telling him this, he says, are white liberals. The very people who would like to distinguish themselves from the kind of vicious, overt racist in the South, these are well-meaning, well-intentioned white people, but who can never stop reminding you that that you're here on the basis of our benevolence. He really bridles at that. So on the one hand, he will say, you know, I definitely, you know, got ahead in part because of affirmative action. He even admits at one point, as I recall, that, you know, George W. H.W. Bush, you know, appointed him in part because he was black, something that Bush completely denied, but was obviously true. And yet, for him, the problem with it is that it again it prevents black people from claiming this achievement is theirs, and so he feels like it's a major assault on dignity, that it reinforces this stigma, and it always ensures that black people you know, carry this around with them. So, despite admitting it, you know, I think he has an argument about why he thinks it's harmful. And again, what's important is that it doesn't harm white people, it harms black people. And this, I think, gets to your second question. Won't white people's views, I think Thomas would say no. And in his own experience would be exhibit A, that he trot out for that, that it didn't change. You know, the fact that he was there around all these white people hasn't changed their perception of the black community. And again, I think the other point, and this gets back to the separatism. I mean, he has said in some of his opinions, black students do better, will do better when they're by themselves, apart from white people. They will learn more. They will take more pride in their achievements. They will get further. So he's, you know, sort of supported HBCUs in one opinion, and you know, has really called into question whether or not integrating and diversifying institutions does much to benefit black people. He thinks white people are benefited from it, not because they become more knowledgeable about black people, but because they get to style themselves as sophisticated and cosmopolitan. And, you know, look, here's me with all my diverse friends. And he thinks he uses the word racial aesthetic over and over and over again. And he thinks white people have a racial aesthetic that calls for black faces at the table. But it's not really about establishing any kind of, you know, knowledge or interaction in any real sense.
So now, and I guess what I was saying about the numbers was not that the presence of, you know, of black people amongst white people in any type of numbers is going to change the perspective of white people. I'm just stipulating his notion that it's immutable, this perspective. But I'm just saying sheer numbers. Like, at one point, the trajectory of our population is going to be, at the very least, that white people are not going to be the dominant in terms of numbers. I mean,
oh, you know, I see what you mean. And, I mean, I think that, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, and you know, and I have to say, like, you know, the fact, just the, I think that there is certainly some merit to the perspective of, like, affirmative action is, it can be used against you as a black person. I mean, I raise it in the context of this you know, this conversation.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, that's you know, in part some evidence towards his assertion. I don't think it has the same implications, and I want to talk about, like, sort of the psychology involved in all of this,
right?
Relative to, like, it informing Supreme Court decisions from a guy who's sort of a supposedly a strict constructionist, but
right.
but just what about that notion of, like,
sheer numbers?
In sheer numbers.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know if he ever really considers it explicitly. I think if I were to guess an answer, and this is me speculating, I think he would say, you know, remember, he's a black nationalist. That's where he comes from. And politically, intellectually, and stuff. And I think there's a specificity to the African-American experience to him. And so the fact that schools will be more diverse, maybe with South Asian people, maybe with Latinos, Asian-Americans, I think for him, you know, the real question, it really comes down to black people. And black people are going to remain a minority, just numerically. And this is, you know, what he has come back to. You know, so the combination of the kind of low social status and the history of racism and all the rest of it, plus just the numerical fact of being, you know, 11% of the population, I think he sees African Americans as kind of an exceptional minority. If, you know, in standard parlance, Asian Americans are the model minority, or Jewish Americans, you know, he sees African Americans as the most degraded minority. And very separate, and their experience is very apart. This isn't a general, you know, affirmation of people of color kind of argument. This is
right.
Specific to the black community.
Fair enough. So let's.
But that was speculation.
Right. No, I understand. I think that's. Yeah. I think that's possible. Although it's sort of hard to reconcile from he's married to a white woman and yep. he's, you know, these are weird sort of contradictions. It feels like, at least, I mean, who knows? All right. So let's talk about how he squares all of these sort of like psychological assessments of white people and of society and whatnot with the Constitution. 'Cause you conceive of it as he sees a white Constitution and a black Constitution.
Yeah. So you brought up before this question of him supposedly being a strict constructionist, you know, somebody who's faithful to the Constitution. And in the contemporary world, the word that gets bandied about is an originalist. And I'm just sort of giving some background to the question you're asking here. And originalists are supposed to be people who faithfully interpret the Constitution in accordance with the words as they were originally understood or intended. There's some argument about that. And people often cite Thomas, both his defenders and his critics, as an originalist. And the truth is, he's not really an originalist at all. He's very opportunistic in his originalism. Sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't. And it's very hard to square, as you suggested, a lot of his positions with an originalist position. However, one of the issues that comes up in a lot of these debates is, when you say originalism, do you mean the Constitution as it was adopted in 1787 and then ratified in 1789, the original Constitution, or do you mean the Constitution that was transformed by the Civil War and Reconstruction right. through the adoption of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments? And the charge against most originalists, conservative originalists, is that they ignore that second Constitution from Reconstruction and the Civil War. Thomas does not ignore that second Constitution. He takes it very seriously, in certain ways far more seriously than most people on either side, at the left or the right. But he has a very particular interpretation of it. In his mind, that second Constitution was transformed by and in the interests of black people, the people who were enslaved. And he thinks out of that experience came a new appreciation of the freedom of black people, but that it's constant, that freedom is very much located in one fundamental right, which is the right to bear arms. There is a long tradition on the black left and in black nationalism of championing the right to bear arms for black people. And Thomas oftentimes channels that tradition, particularly in his opinions. McDonald versus Chicago, which was in 2010, was a classic of this. And he rereads the whole history of the Second Amendment, not as the story of white colonial militias mustering against the British, not as the story of white homeowners in the suburbs protecting themselves from black criminals, all the stereotypes we think of, but instead as the story of black people terrorized by white people, first by the slaveholders and then by white supremacists, and wanting to arm themselves and desperately needing to. And that this is a right that's fundamental, not just to the black community, but also to black masculinity.
All right. So let me just back up. So to give people who may not sort of be terribly familiar with Reconstruction to just sort of like place this. And sure. We should also say that his contemporaries I don't know if it was exactly when he was at Holy Cross, but certainly around that time, were in California basically causing Ronald Reagan to start gun control because they were showing up at city council meetings with shotguns.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Black Panther Party platform is, you know, one of, you know, I can't remember, is about black arms and the right to bear arms and so forth. So it's,
And we should say, though, that, I mean, this is the thing I can't quite get my head around, or I guess maybe I can in some way. Like when we talk about, and I don't know that we've really introduced this concept too much on this show, but about that second Constitution with the addition of the 13th and 14th Amendment, everything that's happening in Reconstruction and the ambitions that lie there. And then basically the beginning of the end of Reconstruction, which was a function of the Colfax massacre, where basically You know, we don't know exactly how many, but like, I don't know, 150, 200, black people were killed in, you know, by essentially the KKK as they do pushback, on the ascendance of black power and Reconstruction. And I guess the argument in his mind is, had they availed themselves of the Second Amendment, this would have, the gains in Reconstruction would have been maintained. Is that it? Because you also talk, he looks back on Jim Crow as an era where it is, you know, sort of some type of model for,
right,
for,
right.
Okay, but take it from there. I just wanted to provide that background.
So, and the importance of the Colfax massacre is that it produces this Supreme Court decision that's about the Second Amendment, Cruikshank, United States versus Cruikshank, or United States versus Cruikshank. Or Cruikshanks versus the United States. And the question is whether or not the Second Amendment applies to the states. And this is from the 1870s. And the court says, no, it doesn't. It's a federal right. And this is viewed oftentimes as the kind of one of the beginnings or one of many setbacks for Reconstruction. So Thomas is not being all that peculiar there in arguing that, you know, the right to arm black people and for black people to protect themselves was considered one of the critical rights, and that for black freedom, and that when it was taken away, it helped sow the seeds of this major backlash. I don't think Thomas would go, and then here we come to the second part of your question, I don't think he would go so far as to say, you know, Reconstruction could have lasted, because it doesn't fit with his pessimism. I think it, and this gets into this question of black masculinity and black dignity. I think he sees black people being able to defend themselves, not as a vehicle to some kind of transformation towards a multiracial society, but towards a condition for their survival and their dignity apart from white people. It's a way to protect themselves from white marauders and to develop their own institutions apart from white people. And again, it's very focused on black men. He closes his decision in McDonald with the memory of an older black man, thinking back when he was a young boy and seeing his father stand in the doorway holding off a white mob with a gun. Thomas says something like it was an image of salvation or something like that. And that's a very resonant element in the black tradition. This idea of black men arming themselves, not to transform the society. And again, so it's not that Reconstruction could have lasted, but more that they could have at least protected themselves and shepherded themselves to some kind of life apart from white people. And then I think we get into what Jim Crow was for him. That for all the degradations of Jim Crow, the fact that black people could not look to the state for aid and provision meant that they were forced back on themselves. And here his grandfather is a really important model for him. His grandfather raised him. He was a black small business owner in Savannah, and amassed wealth and property. And Thomas says, you know, I owe almost everything to him and that example. And he was very stern and kind of an Old Testament patriarch kind of a figure, and very authoritative. And he said these were the kinds of men who, in the face of the worst degradation from white society and the white state, helped build up the black race, helped build the black people with resources that were internal to them, where they were not dependent on white people. And that, for him, is why Jim Crow is kind of in a golden age. And it's an extraordinarily romantic fantasy. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about this. I don't say it in the book because I prefer to let the, you know, text, you know, the words speak for themselves. But it's, you know, this is that vision.
It's one where I think like even casual observers of the right today would see that. Like, it reminds me immediately of Paul Ryan's, you know, apocryphal story about the black kid who comes to school and would much rather have a brown bag lunch than a lunch provided by the public school because it gives them the dignity and this and that. And it turned out to be like a compilation of a couple of stories that were all fabricated. But nevertheless, that's the same sort of mythology, right? Like this idea of when you are completely stripped of any societal support, that's when you become your real you, if you're a guy.
Yes. And this is, I think, you know, people have asked me what's the connection between Thomas and some of the arguments of the reactionary mind. And this was, I said, you know, at the heart of the reactionary mind was this idea that under these conditions of tremendous exigency and adversity and constraint, where there's very little support for you from, and again, for Thomas, this is a particular valence, very little support from you from white people, He doesn't mind getting support from black people, and he, again, we'll talk about his grandfather and the support he got from his grandfather and sometimes his grandmother and other people like that. But when you're sort of thrown back, when the black community is thrown back on itself, these resonant, powerful, patriarchal men will rise to the occasion. And he sees liberalism. He sees the civil rights movement. He sees the Warren Court and the New Deal as assaults on these generations of black men, and that what they did was they crippled their will and discipline, their iron will to and their sense of responsibility to the black community. They just devitalized them by making life too easy. And Thomas wants to make life hard for black people, not because he loathes black people, and not because he loves black people either, but because he believes that in a racist society like the United States, black people need all the internal power and organization they can get apart from white people, and that black men are the ones to provide it. And he has said explicitly, you know, the salvation of the black race depends upon black men. But to get those types of black men, these patriarchal figures, you have to create conditions of exigency and constraint so that they can overcome them and develop the internal power and skills. And so it's a very disturbing and unsettling picture by the end of the book, and it's meant to be deliberately unsettling and disturbing because it begins from these premises that I think some people on the left would find recognizable, and then it ends in this horrible dystopia that happens to look very much like the world that we live in today.
And you know, I want to wrap this up, and I appreciate you're hanging with me for so long on this today. But it also occurs to me that when you contemplate the centrality of masculinity or malehood to that political project he has, that it puts into context his claim that the Anita Hill appearance at his hearings was a high tech lynching, because it wasn't just that this was happening to a black person; it's happening to a black man,
right?
And exactly. And that becomes central to the essence of. I mean, it's almost like there is no racism if it's not a guy who's being subjected to it in his mind.
Yeah, and this came up, in fact, during the Anita Hill. I mean, the whole, you know, the theory of intersectionality of Kimberly Crenshaw predates it, but it got traction and popularity coming out of that, and influence coming out of that experience, because it was depicted as Thomas represents race, Thomas is black, and Hill represents women. And what people said is, you know, the real question there is who gets to represent, why was it forgotten that Anita Hill was also black? And I think you have hit, you know, the head on the nail here, which is that for Thomas, racism is directed, I think, against the black community, but because he understands the centrality, because he believes in the centrality of black men to the fate of black community, racism really takes its form against black men. And there's very little role in his, you know, I call it a dreamscape. There's very little role for black women in that story, except either as traitors, and that's how he views Anita Hill, or as kind of weak-willed figures of dependency.
So, all right. So lastly, how much do you think his colleagues or the conservative legal movement understand the underpinnings, how relevant is it that they do? Do they just sort of cherry pick what they like that comes out of him? And what are the implications going forward for us with this? And sure. Please answer in 30 seconds.
Okay.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
Oh, okay. I was going to try. It's very clear to me most white conservatives either have not a clue what he's really talking about or are very selectively interpreting him. And there's a long history of that with him. Some do, but many don't. But in a way, I don't think it matters. And I think this is where his story becomes part of a larger political story that's relevant to all of us. Because what is so clear in his jurisprudence is how easy it is to fit this very pessimistic view of race with all of these conservative positions. And then when you have the election of someone like Trump, who, by the way, has said that Clarence Thomas is his favorite justice, Trump's white nationalism is also premised upon this view that the world is divided by races or maybe cultures, and that, you know, white people have a special destiny apart from darker-skinned people. And our assumption that this country is, you know, racially polarized in a way that it has never been before, which I think is not true. I think we have been racially polarized sometimes worse before. But anyway, you start to see how Thomas is actually not just speaking for himself, and he's not even speaking for the right. He's advocating, but also describing a world that is very much the world we live in. That is to say, massive accumulations of wealth in the hands of a few, mass incarceration, which is something that he supports, predominantly with higher percentages of people, black men in the black community, getting incarcerated, and you know, racial conflict and racial pessimism, as far as the eye can see, and people armed to the teeth. And this is Thomas's world. This is the world that he sees. This is the world that he believes in. So his significance, whether white conservatives know or don't know what's going on in his opinions, really transcends them. I think there's no more resonant representative voice on the Supreme Court who so speaks to the nation as it is currently constituted as Clarence Thomas.
Well, that's a little bit terrifying, but also fascinating, and I appreciate your sharing it with us. Corey Robin, we will put a link to the Enigma of Clarence Thomas on majority.fm. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Bye-bye. Bye. There you have it, folks. He is the senior member of the Supreme Court, and soon to be, I mean, not soon, 9 years, but, you know, in Supreme Court justice.
It's only
years,
1 year in Supreme Court dog years.
Exactly. He will be the longest serving Supreme Court justice. And we didn't get to this, and I don't know, these opinions from Clarence Thomas also provide, and you don't hear about it too much, but, you know, guys like him, Thomas Sowell, who I think, he's not just aligned with, but I think friendly with, end up providing just enough cover, internal cover for conservatives to provide them with a sense of, like, you know, this is, you know, we have a black person saying this, so it must be... okay. Scary. That is not our Halloween show. We had that a couple of days ago. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is our members who make this possible. You will support interviews like the one we just did with Corey Robin. And the ones we will do later in the week and the ones we did last week. You go back and forth, forward, back, forward, back. If we are in the middle of things, which I hope we're not, I hope we would go further with this show, but it'd be 9 years going forward, 9 years going back, almost to the day. Wait a second. When's the show birthday? Somebody on this?
Yeah, the, yeah.
None
get
of
on
us
it.
Were around at
exactly.
Its
thank Brendan playing the role of the Dorsey AI algorithm
was.
That you.
Dorsey
right
was.
Now.
Dorsey was around.
Dorsey was.
You should have figured this out.
Well, now you got to go outside
anymore.
Of the office to find blame. Dorsey. Keep track of your own dates, bro. You know your kids' birthdays, right?
No, it took me a long time to remember that, actually. Hold on. Let's
points
see.
It
for
was
honesty.
My 2-year work anniversary very recently.
Holy cow!
Thanks for noticing.
It was yesterday. The 9-year anniversary of the show. Oh, we launched the show on November 3rd, 2010. Will you look at that? Well, it didn't fall. November 3rd falled on a Sunday. So, that's amazing. And then I think we were all in soft launch at that point. And I don't know when we got to hard launch. That took a long time to just, we had, I don't know. There you have it. We've been doing this for 9 years as of yesterday, which I think, how many shows have we done now? Like 2,500 shows?
Per Libsyn, this will be 2,212th.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's a little bit more than that. I don't know if when we started numbering it, but what was it? To what?
2,212.
It makes me, like, I feel like I'm going to pass out when you say that number. But folks, the reason why we've been able to do 2,000 blah, 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 12 or whatever it is because of our members. And you can help us do the next 2,000 blah, 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 12 numbers of shows over the next 9 years by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show without commercials, and you get extra content. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. They have been with us, I think, all 9 years. I think all 9 years. Check them out. You'll love their coffee. You can get the Majority Report blend. And just a reminder, Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business, with over 1 million reviews from real software users. Discover everything you need to make an informed decision. This is all free, incidentally, at Capterra. So go to capterra.com/majority, and it's free. Find it. Go today. Find the tools to make an informed decision for your business about software. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's CAPTERRA.com/majority. CAPTERRA, Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified. Michael, today is Monday. Tomorrow will be Tuesday. What will happen?
What will happen is we will play this interview that I recorded a couple weeks ago, which had been available for patrons, with Adolf Reed Jr. on essentialism, the managerial class, South Africa, this election, many other things. This is one of the most important interviews I've ever done with one of the most important people we have writing today, who actually would shed some interesting light on some of the things that Robin brought up in the context of analyzing Clarence Thomas. Then Abby Martin joins us. She makes her debut talking about her documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom. I will say Nando Vila is going to come hang out with us in the post game. We're going to be talking about Chinese triads and soccer price fixing, as well as an update on Catalonia. Whole bunch of other things. On Sunday, for patrons, we talked with the Asia Times' Pepe Escobar on a multipolar world and the BRICS as an offensive strategy for giving more power to underdeveloped countries. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Grab your Philly tickets. Those are only a handful left before November 23rd at World Cafe. And there's a couple of other events, but just look at my Twitter for them.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have a premium offering, part 2 of 2 of History is a Weapon on the Rise and Fall of Suburbia with Sean and Matt Chrisman, in which they bring our story of suburbia up to the present moment when the periphery is in crisis and urban areas are suffering late-stage gentrification. How is Los Angeles the archetypal American city? Who developed suburbia and why? Which class interests are upheld by the primacy of real estate in American political economy? And whither suburban life in the 21st century? All this and more with an analysis of that class fraction everyone's talking about these days, the professional managerial class. Also, out this Wednesday is a free episode wherein Sean talks with Billy O'Connor and John Tormey, two of his fellow tradesmen, on the conservatism of business unionism, the mythology surrounding the quote-unquote white working class, and how to turn everyday hatred of the boss into radical class consciousness. So that's one for all you vulgar workerists out there to enjoy.
Matt!
Yeah, check out my Salem Witch Trials episode of Literary Hangover, folks. You'll like it.
Okay, how's this for mind-blowing? So Kyle is like, we got to do something epic for the 10-year anniversary, right? It's going to be November 3rd, 2020.
Right before the election?
Not before.
Day of. Oh.
Day.
Damn.
Of election.
That's so intense.
Isn't it?
That's crazy. Shut up, Brendan. Jesus.
Look at that. That is New Jersey news right there.
I am not.
Everybody's got to work extra hours to get cold so that day.
I am not.
What if we did random rush, but for like 7 hours?
Well, it's the anniversary. You couldn't do it for 7 hours.
You could do a backlog.
Oh, that's true.
We could do a pre-record. And then maybe you could record a new ad that takes place 10 years after Who's the Caboose, advertise Who's the Caboose.
Doing a whole day. Doing a
12-hour
show that day. Like, because from 12 to midnight, right? I mean, it sort of depends on who the two candidates are. If it's Joe Biden, I'll do it.
If it's Biden, I boycott.
If it's Joe Biden, I'm going to have a tough time doing that. I'm going to feel like those 10 years may not have been totally worth it. Yeah, exactly.
If Biden's the nominee, I want to I want to be somewhere warm to watch those results. I just want to be like, let's just hope that senile old man beats the other senile old man.
I just want
some bereavement/hazard pay if it's Biden.
If it's Biden and Trump, there's a good chance that on November 4th, this becomes like a, I don't know what kind of show, like just, yes, maybe survivalist show or something like that. Or I want to say sports, but I don't know if I'm going to want to get into sports at that point. I have a feeling it's going to be video game. I'm just going to go full on Twitch at that point. All right, folks, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there.
take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.